pano yasa bhagavato savaka sangho tamayang bhagavantang sadamang sasangang ime hi sakare hiyatavahang avopite hiyabhipujayama sadhuno bhante bhagava suchira harinipotopi pachima janata nukampamanasa ime sakare dukkata panna kala bhute patikan hatu amhakang ikharatang itaya sukaya alahang sama sambodho bhagava buddhang bhagavantang apivadeimi suvakato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namassami supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghang namami namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa iti piso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho vijacchavana sampanno sukhato lokavidu anuttaro purissa dhamma savatti satate vamanusana bhutto bhagava tamahang bhagavantang apipujayami tamahang bhagavantang sirasanamami suvakato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko akaliko ehi pasiko opanayiko pachyatang veditapo vinyuhi tamahang dhammang apipujayami tamahang dhammang sirasanamami supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho yayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho samichipatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho yadidang chatari Purisa Yugani Ata Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Sawakasango Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anuttarang Punyaketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in
Not the last time, tomorrow morning. Who knows what the future may bring? Da-da-da. Here we go. Wow. Oh, here's the first question. Comes out by itself. And the question is, thank you, Leha. Thank you, Christina. Thank you, Sudama, for a wonderful retreat. May you be well and happy with blessings of the Noble Triple Gem. Thank you, Leha. Thank you, Christina. Thank you, Sudama. No, I'm sure you thank me also. Dear Ajahn, what are your views on assisted dying, voluntary euthanasia? Thank you. Sometimes as some people I think be a very good idea. I think no, it can't be like that, Ajahn Brahm. But seriously, if it's assisted dying, if it is somebody else, you want to help them die, then that's not really a nice thing. It should be their choice. They should be in control of their dying process. So if you see someone, like that silly joke I said just a moment ago, that if you think you want to put them out of your misery, that's actually what it is. You're putting them out of your misery. So no one has really got the right to actually to do that to another being. But the assisted dying, voluntary euthanasia, that is when a person takes control of their dying process. And one of that was the first global conference which we did here in Perth, because I wanted to find out, just voluntary assisted euthanasia, exactly what it is, and get it from the experts. So at that conference we had, the premier at the time, that was Jeff Gallup. We also had this gentleman called Dr. Philip Nitschke from Exit International. So I invited him to come up and just give a presentation. Now, what is voluntary euthanasia? And so he gave a very nice presentation. He says that there's all sorts of things, boxes to tick, sort of hurdles to jump, before you get even close to the final bit of voluntary euthanasia, where the doctor, puts a drip in your arm, and you've got a little computer. And, many times you have to be asked questions, you know what you're doing, is this really free? You're not being compelled by anybody. Why are you doing this? And many, many times, it takes a while to answer all the questions. And the final questions, if you press this button, then the whatever it is going to kill you will be secreted into that line which goes into your arm. And so it is really very voluntary. It's very hard to see how anybody could take control of that process and actually do the killing for you. It has to be you make those decisions. And you are the owner of your karma. It's up to you. And sometimes in my life as a Buddhist monk, you can understand why people make that choice. Basically, the quality of life is really just not there. And other people are actually having to spend a lot of time and money on you. And so because of that, it was the first person in Australia to legally have voluntary euthanasia. It was a gentleman called Arthur Dent. He lived in Darwin, but he was a Buddhist. And because he was a Buddhist, when he came to get some treatment in Royal Perth Hospital, that one of the monks used to stay here, Ajahn Dhammo, went to go and visit him. And so he told me, what was going on with him and why he was even considering voluntary euthanasia. And he said the main reason wasn't, him. It was no quality of life, no possibility of recovery, very, very painful condition. But he said his wife was having to look after him 24/7, And even though she had respite, you know, she was always worried and concerned about him. She was committed to him. And so he said his main number one reason why he took voluntary euthanasia eventually was to give his wife some freedom so his wife could have her life back instead of looking after him all the time. That was his reason. You can argue with that, but you don't. No one really knows unless you're in that situation. And so because of that, as far as Buddhism is concerned, it is no bad karma. Your karma is your intention. What are you doing that for? Why are you doing that? And if your motivation is predominantly out of concern for others, out of compassion, loving kindness, it's very hard to see that that could be bad karma. So, you know, you don't want to make sure that, you know, that somebody else sends you to voluntary euthanasia. You know, they say, Venerable Sangha, I send you off to voluntary euthanasia, fed up with you. I would never do that to anybody, obviously. But, you know, that is not right. It has to be a personal decision. So I have to be really competent to make that decision. And all of the reasons why you could make the decision because of some psychological trauma or some negativity or whatever, that has to be taken away. Now I'm going to ask you a question. Did the Buddha commit voluntary euthanasia? Our Buddha, yeah. How did the Buddha die? You probably all know the story. There's a meat he ate just before he passed away. And he knew what he was doing. And he said, only I can eat that meat. And after he ate it, he threw it away. No other monk could eat it. Did he know what he was doing? And also, beforehand, 3 months beforehand, at the chapel of shrine in Waisali, Mara came. And Mara said to him, do you remember, just after you became ordained, after you became enlightened, he said to the Buddha, this is Mara, he said, you promised that you would enter Parinibbana, you leave, you know, the 5 khandhas, once you had a strong sangha of monks, a strong sangha of bhikkhunis, lots of lay men and lay women, the fourfold assembly, once that is very strong, then you've done your job. And Mara said, you've done your job. There's lots of enlightened monks, enlightened nuns, lay people, lay men following these teachings. So I said, you can go now. And so the Buddha said, yeah, fair enough. So the Buddha, he decided it was time to go. It was a voluntary decision to leave samsara. Was that euthanasia? Did the Buddha commit suicide? I say that to sort of stir people up because sometimes if you look at it, what is suicide anyway? The intentional decision to end your life. That's the Buddha, okay, so that doesn't count for you. You keep carrying on. Anyway, dear Ajahn, today my theme was care for the moment. Could you share some caring thoughts about this? I will do it in this moment. Okay, the moment's gone now. Now, caring for this moment is wonderful. What is caring for this moment? It's the Emperor's Three Questions again. Now is the most important time. Now is the only time you have. It's this moment. This is it. And what do you do with this moment? Give it importance. So give it importance. Because sometimes this moment can slip away because there's other things which are really important. Like sort of breakfast tomorrow morning. Or like, I'm going to the toilet. Or whatever it is you plan for the future. So if you give this moment importance, and then you care for it. That's Emperor's Three Questions, and it really works. And I do that a lot, the Emperor's Three Questions meditation, and it's really powerful sometimes. So it's a simple meditation technique. If you do it properly and you know how to care, that's one of the hard bits. Because a lot of times people think, well, we know how to care. Do you? What is caring? Not trying to judge anything or make anything different. Not trying to develop it or just tweak away all its imperfections. It really is caring for it. Letting it grow at its own rate. And, you know, sometimes we have had children. Do you really care for them? Well, we think we do. But sometimes we expect things out of our children. That's why, you know, sometimes a grandmother can care for the grandkids much better. I remember my grandma. She was really cool. Because I could go to her house at any time, the day and night, especially in the afternoon, late afternoon. And she'd ask me, you know, my lay name was Peter, and she said, what do you want, Peter? Do you want some chips? It's in the afternoon, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. So it's not easy to do. She had to peel a potato, sort of chop it up, fry it up, and give me some chips for the afternoon. And my mother would really tell her, you can't do that to my son. He's going to miss his dinner. He won't be hungry. And my grandma said, if my grandson wants chips, he gets chips. And I love my grandma for that. She spoiled me. But, you know, that was her privilege and that was her right and duty. So anyway, because of that, she cared for me. It was unconditional. It doesn't matter what you want to eat. If you want to eat it, you can eat it in my house. And something was in there which, you know, that she trusted me. I wouldn't do that too often. And it was only because, you know, she loved me and cared for me. And that was just love me and cared for me, and without conditions. My mother, she's had the responsibility of bringing me up. She sort of owned me. She had responsibilities. Grandma didn't. That's why sometimes the caring for somebody, caring for yourself, care as if, you know, you have no responsibilities, how it turns out. You're just caring for yourself. Okay. Dear Ajahn, this is a very long question. I need to tell you that something is very seriously, importantly, truly, completely, definitely, absolutely, obviously. Thank you so much to Ajahn Brahm. It's an amazing retreat. Thanks again to everyone. Metta with loving kindness. Very good. Excellent. Wonderful. It's a very long letter. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. I've heard some Dhamma teachers say that some enlightened people behave badly. Is this possible? Not really. Depends what you call acting badly. If it's like eating too many chips, that's not bad behavior, is it? Is it? No. No, it's if a person is enlightened, obviously they're caring. And so they would never do anything, you know, to you, to say something to you, to do something to you, to hurt you on purpose. You know, but sometimes when we say something, sometimes people can misunderstand it. Or they can just get it wrong, or whatever happens in this life. Sometimes you can never be perfect. You can always be kind. So enlightened beings will always be kind. They won't always be perfect. Sometimes they make mistakes. Or are those people who say they're enlightened, their followers are just delusion? That's more likely. Isn't it impeccable conduct could be conditional for enlightenment? Yeah. So impeccable conduct means that there's no wanting to own people or control them, no just wanting anything out of them at all. So you just, we give, we share. And that's all. So an enlightened being can't want anything. That's one of the reasons why if anybody claims to be enlightened, test them out. Say to them, yeah, you enlightened? Ah, come on. And like enlightened beings, they can't eat sweetened condensed milk. And see what they say. Or I can only say this at the end of the retreat. Or when you bring them some of the tea in the morning, you can forget the condensed milk. And see what they say. And if I say, Eddie, be the cadet's milk, or I'll never let you be in the Buddhist society again. Then that shows you're not enlightened. But yeah, sometimes, okay. You don't want to do that, fine. Anyway, what am I answering that question for? So, enlightened Dhamma teachers, they can't be cruel and harsh. They have to keep, you know, the rules of the society as well as their own Vinaya rules. And the Vinaya rules is the rules of harmlessness and service. And we also have, you know, in our modern age, I should say this, in our modern age, there are some Dhamma teachers, you know, who abuse their disciples. And that is really, really wrong. And sometimes they say, oh, I'm testing you. You don't need to test people that way. You don't want to inspire people. And so a lot of times those Dhamma teachers who actually sexually abuse their disciples, physically abuse their disciples, it's very, very, very dubious that they even deserve to be monks or nuns. So because of that we have good monks and good nuns. And obviously the nice thing about this place and our traditions is you should be able to go and check the monks out. You've already gone to see my cave, many of you. And that's where I do live. And that's where I hang out. I've got my office next door, but it's the cave where I spend most of my time. And so you can see where I live, and that's true, that's me. So you can actually check people out. And if only the select few can go inside their room, then this must be something they were trying to hide. I lived with Ajahn Chah for 9 years. And often people say, was he enlightened? He's a great speaker and says some amazing, wonderful things. But was he really enlightened? And the one thing which convinced me was, I think the last year I was with him, he asked me to get something from his room. And he never lets anyone go into his room except, you know, his attendant. I never had the role of his attendant. But anyway, he asked me to go up to his room and get something. The first time I've been in his private quarters. And I opened the door and, oh, it was amazing. There's hardly anything there. By this time, he was a very, very famous monk. And he had kings and queens and prime ministers coming to see him. And all he had was a grass mat, not even a mattress, a wooden pillow. And his robe, spare robe on the line. That's about it. And the simplicity of his personal quarters was really, really impressive. He didn't own anything, didn't want anything. So if you see someone who's enlightened, who drives around in a Rolls Royce, there's something a bit wrong there. If you see a monk with a Rolex watch, I know a monk with a watch, it's got Rolex on the outside. That's Ajahn Santuti, one of my monks. He's got a Rolex watch. He shows it to me. See my Rolex watch? I think his family got it in Vietnam for a dollar. It's a fake. But he loves taking it out to show, yeah, well, my Rolex watch, it's a fake Rolex. But I also remember being in his conference in Singapore. And in the conference of Singapore, during the question time, someone stood up, got the microphone. We know there's about 5 or 6 of us on the panel. Is it okay that a monk has a Rolex watch? And the monk sitting next to me put his hand on the table very quickly. Yeah. One of the monks did have one. What do you want one of those for? Anyway. While having breakfast this morning, I couldn't taste the olive leaf condiment that is served with rice porridge. When I ate a piece of apricot, it tasted like a piece of mango. Why is the confusion with the taste of food? I thought I am going mad after 8 days of meditation. Thank you. Are you sure it really was olive leaf? Or an impersonation? Are you really sure it's a piece of mango? Because sometimes the fruit all looks the same. You might have got a fake mango. But anyway, sometimes what happens, you know, obviously it could be just some other flavors in the porridge. But it also can be, you know, even the mango tastes different at different times. And also there is the opportunity, the possibility, I should have said, the possibility that if you have very good meditation, you can actually taste deeper flavors in what you're tasting. Things actually do taste different from good meditation. So it could have really been that. If it's really, really beautifully wonderful flavor, then that means that was a good meditation you had beforehand. Which is one of the reasons why when you get home, don't you enjoy eating food? Well, if you should meditate. If you're going out with your partner to a nice expensive restaurant, say we better meditate for half an hour beforehand so we can really enjoy the flavor of that restaurant. And tell your partner when you go to the restaurant that to really be mindful of the flavors of the food, tell your partner to shut up. If you want to have a nice conversation with your partner when you go to a restaurant, you might as well go to McDonald's or Hungry Jack's or something, you know, because you don't taste the food because you're paying attention to the conversation. And especially, you know, you cooks at home who cook for your partner and family, that should be, you know, obvious. It's a lot of work and effort to cook for others. So if you've done all that work cooking for others, you should tell your family to shut up while you're cooking or to shut up while they're eating. So they could fully appreciate all the efforts and kindness and skill of your cooking when they eat it. Would that be possible? The monks were always quiet when we eat. In fact, we were just trained to always be silent when we're eating, that sometimes when you go to someone's house and they sit in front of you while you're trying to eat, it's very difficult sometimes to wonder what to do. We're just, you know, trying to eat and talk at the same time, you're not really appreciating the food. Anyway, confusion with the taste of the food, you're not going mad, but, you know, when you do have some good meditation, deep meditation, it does affect your the perceptions of your taste. Dear Ajahn, let's say three loud sadhus for the wonderful service given by Christine, Leha, Sudama, Anusha, and the laity who gave the superb cooked meals. Not forgetting Upasaka Nicholas and Anusha. I'm not on it. All the hard work. No. Okay, yeah, why not? Appreciation is always really good. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Oh, my goodness. Things to do on retreat. Nothing. Relax to the max. Let go. Be kind. Gratitude to Ajahn Brahm. At last, I've made it. Sorry, I'm already messing. And appreciating the retreat manager and beautiful auntie in the kitchen. Yeah. But number one, first of all, nothing. I'll get that one finished first. And then you go on to number two. It appears clear to me now. Don't encourage me. That deep meditation, the good stuff, require large amounts of time spent on the cushion and sustained mindfulness. Is there any way to short-circuit this process? Or is it true insight only available on retreat? short-circuiting it and just making it fast. What do you want? And when you realize it's a wanting, you know, nice deep meditations or great insights, that is the obstacle. So if you want the fast path, don't want anything. Just, you know, just be here, be happy just to meditate. Cross your legs. Everything else is just extra gravy bonus. But just the ability to just cross your legs, close your eyes and be peaceful. With no one asking you to do anything. There's no exams afterwards. No one's going to judge and criticize you. So don't judge and criticize yourself. And if after the retreat, when you go home, your friends say, what did you get on the retreat? Exactly, say nothing. Noisy. Lucid, yeah. I just got nothing. I lost a lot. I didn't lose anything. You know, when we started the COVID time, not so many people could come to the monastery. And I really thought I could flatten my curve. It didn't work. Oh, well. At least, now, it's about a couple of years I haven't put on weight. I got so much you can't put on anymore. No, not that much. Anyway, yeah, the deep meditation requires large amounts of time. Now, it takes a large amount of patience. Not time, but patience. The ability to sit here and just wait for things to happen. Let them happen, rather than trying to expect something. A large degree of letting go. And that's not time. Remember, I think I said that time is created by wanting. We don't want anything. Time just loses much of its meaning. Dear Ajahn, when a mother conceives triplets on multiple goodness gracious me. When a mother conceives triplets or multiple conceptions, any thoughts on Patisandhi Vijnana? Thank you for your teaching. Yeah, just that's Patisandhi Vijnana, connecting consciousness. It's just each one of those kids, they have separate consciousnesses, come from different places. So three streams of consciousness come into the mother's womb. And maybe there may have been triplets before. Maybe all sorts of things. Why a type of consciousness comes into the mum's womb, and when you get two or three at the same time. I'm just trying to think of this. Not that many. There's one set of twins who are Buddhists. And unfortunately, they were from Ireland. And you know, they were born in a pub. So the father owned a pub. And so Irish people are in a nice way. They're very good fun and joking, but they're a bit scallywags. And these two were just really bad scallywags because they were identical twins. So when they went to school, one would stay home. And when the teacher said, one of you wasn't here yesterday, and they said, that's your problem to find out which one. And the teacher couldn't do anything because they've got rules. You can't punish someone when they didn't do it. So they really took advantage of that. And they came here once. There's usually one of them lives in Perth, the other one lives in Dublin or somewhere. When they came here together, they were just... The lady who was looking after them, she just was going mad, crazy, bonkers, because she didn't know which one was which. And I think, so when they left on the airport, how can you tell which one's which? They were totally identical twins, and they knew how to speak the same language, and they looked exactly the same. So identical twins are just really amazing. And I don't know actually why it is or how it is that parents can actually tell the difference. Sometimes a mother knows the difference between those two twins. No one else does. Anyway, but an interesting case. To show how sometimes if it's twins or if it's triplets, sometimes there is some reason or some attraction why these three beings get into the same womb. And these three beings are going to really connect together. And this was a story, Heidi Dennis told me this story about when he went to a conference and one of the people over in Sydney had regressed this poor young girl, she's about 16, who was anorexic. And the poor young lady who's anorexic they tried everything to try and cure this disease, and she was just getting so bad that she was dying. And so the mother decided, let's try one of these hypnotic regression therapists. Nothing to lose, except a bit of money, a bit of time. So she made the appointment. Because this anorexic girl was so young, they had to have the mother in attendance while the hypnotherapy was being done. And so the hypnotist, she managed to regress this girl to her past life pretty quickly. And in this girl's 16-year-old's past life, she remembered that she was the youngest sister of this family. There's only two girls in the family. She was the younger sister. And both girls fell in love with the same guy. And she was really madly in love with this guy, so was her elder sister. But the elder sister was more attractive than the younger one. And so the guys being guys married the elder sister. And the younger sister was so heartbroken that she committed suicide. And in this life, she was saying, so really over the top, trying to get beautiful and thin by not eating. So she was anorexic because not being attractive in her previous life had caused so much suffering that she killed herself. And that makes a lot of sense. It's like logical. You try not being attractive really hurt her so much. But this time she really went over the top trying to be thin. But as she was saying all of this, the mother was being hysterical. And when this poor hypnotist had to calm both down, take the young girl out of hypnosis and calm down the mum. And when the mother had calmed down, she said, "Why were you doing that for? Why are you hysterical?" And that's when the mum said, "I never told my daughter. This happened before she was born. And I had a sister, a younger sister, who committed suicide because we both fell in love with the same guy, her dad." So what had happened? Two sisters fall in love with the same guy. One got the guy, the other one committed suicide and got reborn as that man's daughter. Couldn't be his wife, became his daughter instead. And she said, "I never told my daughter that. It was one of those things you don't talk about in the family when someone commits suicide. It's true." So they came back together again. Last life sisters, this life mother and daughter. Sometimes in hypnotic regression, they reveal really weird things from the past. But anyway, it means that for some unfinished karma, we come together again. Anyway, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for sharing your wisdom and jokes, wisecracks. Would you please talk about 108, especially the origins, and why this number is so auspicious? I don't know. Sometimes auspicious numbers. Sometimes there are many hotels, they don't have a 13th floor. But not in sort of Chinese culture, because 13th floor is nothing. They don't believe that. They don't have the fourth floor in Thailand and China, because the fourth floor means die. It means you're dead. So it's not a very nice floor to have in a hospital in Thailand. What floor are you on? The dead floor. And so lucky number in China is again 8. So everyone has to be on the 8th floor, or the 88th floor, or anything to do with 8. Oh, 18 is lucky. But anyway, people have all these lucky numbers. So, which is the nicest lucky number? I don't know. So, when it says 108, why is that especially number, especially lucky? I don't know. Remember I usually tell this story tomorrow. That was the story. It was the last story, the 108th story in my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. Remember, that was the story about the two monks. And these two monks, they were best friends. And they hang out together just most of their monastic life. And then when they died, one of the monks got reborn up in the heaven realm. And after a while, you know, he wondered what happened to his best friend. So he checked, you know, with the powers in the heaven realms. He checked all the heaven realms looking for his mate. And he couldn't find his friend anywhere. He thought, my friend must have been reborn as a human being. Because the human realm is very fortunate, so they say. Actually, only people in the human realm say that. So, got reborn, so he looked for his friend in the human realm, couldn't find him anywhere. Wonder where he's gone. So he went in the animal realm. Maybe he's been reborn as a dog, because he was lazy. Like I said, being reborn as a dog, you don't have to go to work. You get looked after, you can sleep all day. So he looked for his mate there, and wasn't born as a dog, or any animal like a lion or a tiger. So he looked in the lower animals. Couldn't find him there either, not a mouse or a snake or anything. And then to his horror, when he was looking for him in the realm of the creepy crawlies, there he found his friend, was reborn as a worm in a pile of cow shit. And he didn't know what his friend must have done to get such a terrible rebirth as a worm in a pile of cow poo. But you can't just abandon your friendship. So he went down to that pile of cow poo and he called out to his friend, "Hey, friend, do you remember me?" And this little worm came out, "Yeah, what do you want?" And the heavenly being said, "We were friends in our previous life. I've been reborn in the heavenly realms. You've been reborn in this stinking, smelly, dirty, disgusting pile of shit." And I said, "Hey, what are you talking about? This is my home. I love this pile of cow poo. It's warm, it's fragrant, the best smell in the world. It's my food." Imagine being reborn in a bowl of porridge, for those who like porridge. You can eat porridge all day. And it's nice and warm in a bowl of porridge. It's fragrant. If you like porridge. So anyway, the worm said, "No, I like my home." And the heavenly being said, "Look, if you just see heaven, it's so much more perfect there. You can get whatever you want to eat. It's so perfect, beautiful. All the sights are just so heavenly. The sounds are heavenly. It's so superior." And the worm was very patient until he asked the heavenly being, "But just tell me one thing. Is there any cow poo up in heaven?" He said, "Nope, no cow poo in heaven." "Do they have cows in heaven, do you reckon?" "What do you reckon? Dogs in heaven? You think they have dogs? What about cats? The cats won't be happy." "Be mice in heaven? There's mice in heaven, then the cats will be happy." But anyway, so the worm said, "No cow poo, no go." And so the worm went deeper into the pile of cow poo. And so the heavenly being would not let, you know, the friendship just end that easily. He thought, the heavenly being, If I can only show this little worm how wonderful how wonderful sort of heaven is, who would ever want to stay in Kaupo? So he grabbed hold of the worm. He grabbed it and tried to put it out of the pile of poo. And the worm didn't want to go. And the worm was very slimy because of cow poo makes you very, very sort of like oily. And so it was wriggling and writhing and managed to slip away from the grasp of the heavenly being and escape deeper into the pile of cow poo. But that never stopped the heavenly being. He put his very delicate, fragrant heavenly hand deeper into the poo. And he searched for the worm, found it, and tried to put it out again. And the worm started screaming, "Leave me alone, I'm being worm-napped." We can't say kidnapped, can you? Anyway. And he pulled the worm out, almost got it out, and the worm managed to escape. And in that story, if ever you read it, I say, 108 times the heavenly being tried to pull the worm out of the pile of poo. 108 times that worm escaped. Till eventually the heavenly being had to go back to heaven. And the worm had to stay in his pile of cow poo. Why is that? Because for a worm, the poo is so warm and fragrant and your source of food. Who wants anything else? When I tell that story, sometimes I tell people, "Oh, that means for the last 8 days, I've been trying to pull you out of your cow poo." Sometimes you get close, but then you wriggle away again. So, that's the only thing I know about 108. It's a nice number for stories. Come on here. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how do we let go of responsibility and let go if we have teenagers and something they need? I find it very difficult to balance between holy, spiritual, and family life. Can you kindly comment? Thank you. You're not going to have teenagers forever. So they'll soon. There's the one nice thing with teenagers. When they're 13 or 14, they live at home, and, you know, you try and teach them, but they just want to play games on their computers. Or just, actually, sometimes I tell people this. One of the monks told me this story once. One of his friends always played on computers. You know, computer games, here in Perth. And his mother was always telling him off, "No, do your homework. No, don't waste your time playing on computers." So during the school holidays, this boy, he's only about 14 or 15, invented a game, very popular, made a few million dollars, and his parents never complained again. And when I tell that story, people say, "Please don't tell that story to our kids." I don't know, anyway. So, we're teenagers, and something your needs. I find it very difficult to balance between the spiritual life and the family life. Now, look after your kids. Door of my house, my heart is open to them. And you look after them as much as you possibly can. Care for them. They're going to drive you a bit crazy. But when you have kids, you should look. And that's on the contract. It's in the small print at the bottom of the contract when you have kids, but it's there. They give you a lot of love in the beginning. But when they are sort of the teenage years, it's a lot of problems, difficulties. So see if you can just make sure that they know that mum and dad is there for them. And then afterwards, when they get to about 15 or 16, then mum and dad doesn't see them anymore. They're out all the time. Please make the best use of that. You don't have to worry so much. And sometimes when by the time they're 18 or 19, you know, what you've taught them, what you've given them, they're supposed to be there for their life, but you can't just watch them all the time. There's a time when you have to let go of those kids. And obviously my father was dead when I was 16, but my mother, you know, she had a wonderful attitude. And she would let the children be. We did some stupid things, amazing things. When I was 17, I had a little sleeping bag and my guitar. I went hitchhiking over to North Africa. She must have driven her crazy when she saw me go. I said, "Didn't you worry?" She said, "Yeah, I was worried, but I trusted you." And whatever I did in my life, I gained her trust. I was an ethical person and competent. And because of that, I had the trust of my parents, especially my mother, so she let me go. Some of my needs was recognized by my mother. You know, to have a place to sleep at night, have food, but the freedom to explore my world in whatever I needed to do. And you know, she said, be careful. But I still remember just one of the Sri Lankan families here. The husband, he died. And a heart bypass surgery. And you know, he was one of, I think, about 5% or 4% of the time who didn't survive. And so his wife had four kids, two twins. The guys, two sons and two young daughters. And because she never had a husband and she really respected me, she always came to me for advice when her children got into trouble or whatever. And one day she came to me with her two teenage daughters and said, about 18, said, "My daughters want to go to the nightclub. I'm scared. I told them not to. What should I do?" And so I told them, "Look, your teenage daughters, they need to go to the nightclub. They need to socialize with their friends." And I asked the daughters, "You know, will you take drugs?" And they said, "No." "Alcohol?" I said, no, we won't take anything like that. We just want to have some fun, listen to some music, have a good time with our friends." I said, "Let them go." So they went to the nightclub because the mother trusted me. And I trusted the kids. And those two kids had a wonderful time. One is a doctor in London. I forget what the other one is. They all turned out to be great, great women. So your job as a mother looking after teenage kids is to trust them. And often they will live up to that trust. Very rarely will they not. So, and that's a spiritual life. A spiritual life is not controlling people. Nurturing your mind, teaching it, inspiring it, and trusting it will do good things. Spiritual development is a long journey spanning many lives. It is said that successive human rebirths blessed with material security, happiness and opportunities for further spiritual progress is a result of merits accumulated to the law of karma, according to the law of karma. For some, putting food on the table is a matter of priority, more important than spiritual progress. However, without spiritual progress in this life, the conditions in the next life will not be any better. So how do we balance between focus on material security and spiritual progress? Now you're in Western Australia. There's plenty of food on the table. Have a look what's coming tomorrow. We've had so far. There's no shortage of food in this place. But as I said, you don't need big houses and big cars. Small cars are great. Because small cars, especially old cars, because you can park them anywhere and nobody will steal them. And look at that car. And you know, even sort of thieves have a sense of responsibility and honour. They don't want to sort of steal a small car. But anyhow, so, especially in today's world, you don't need that much. So there should be plenty of time, plenty of opportunity to actually make good spiritual karma. We're living in a very fortunate age. Yeah, we have COVID, but we don't have poverty. And many of you can have plenty to look after yourself. Have you ever seen any hungry people in Perth? You have to go to countries overseas to see really hungry people. Sometimes people may not have a place to stay, but nevertheless, they're always pretty well fed. Dear Ajahn Brahm, we listened to Ajahn Brahmani's death meditation. Did anyone die this afternoon? could have been any good then. And wondering, I'm wondering, would it be suitable to let people going through grief to do this, or people who have suicidal thoughts to do this death meditation? I'm not quite sure what he did. I asked him today what was his death meditation. There's not really a common meditation in the forest tradition to do death meditation. I know there was one of the monks here, he built himself a coffin. He made this coffin in our workshop over the road, and he thought this would be very useful because he can make it, and if any monks died, save a bit of money. And he decided the best thing for it was he was going to sleep in it at night, sleep in a coffin, to remind him of death. And he did that the first night, and it almost killed him. Because there was this, was it MSG board or something? MDF. MDF board, and it had all the chemicals in it, and he was in a small box, no real ventilation, and a stupid muck. But he was hallucinating in the morning. That's not a good idea to do that. Fortunately, he wasn't a very good carpenter or cabinet maker or coffin maker, whatever you call it, because, there was gaps in the joints. And I was very, very lucky, allowed some air in. So sometimes in the Thai tradition, I remember seeing this, that a person would come and we get them to lie on the floor. They put a white cloth over them as if they're dead. Because that's why they used to put white cloths over the corpses. And a red string, of course. Did that joke the other night. And cover them up and say, just pretend you're dead. When they pretend they're dead, and they really try and get into it, what is it like being dead? Letting go of all your possessions, you don't have to worry about a thing. And then we do some chanting for the dead, and then we wait for a little while, and then we do some other chanting for the living. And then they come to again. It's like they've been reborn again. It's that some sort of way of trying to let go of their bad karma from the past, or put it in perspective, let it go. It's like being reborn again, being a born-again Buddhist. I don't know why these Christians keep saying they're born again. Are you born again? Of course you are. We believe in reincarnation. We're all born again Buddhists. Anyway. People have suicidal thoughts. It depends what type of suicidal thought. A lot of times suicidal thoughts, this is actually a serious part of this talk, that being a monk, sometimes you do counsel people. And we did get somebody, a clinical psychiatrist, actually to tell us something about looking after people who have suicidal thoughts. And they said, be very, very careful, because sometimes you're talking to someone who's suicidal and then they look happy again. They don't sort of complain anymore. They look so content. They said, don't think they've been cured. What they've done is they've decided to do it. So the tension of trying to make a decision or not make a decision or whatever has been resolved. Look so peaceful and happy. That doesn't mean that they're not going to do it. It means they've made their decision. They're going to do it. And that was similar to this gentleman. He used to be our caretaker in Anolamara Center many years ago. And he decided for peace and quiet and some serenity to go off to the wheat belt, the town up there, I don't mind saying it, in Beverly. He went over there to stay. He had a nice shed and just a caravan. And, he was a very nice fellow, good meditator, very kind, very generous. But then one day he got into depression. And so badly into depression, he decided to commit suicide. So he'd actually gone into the shed. He tied the string, the rope, onto the rafter and the noose and the chair. So he had everything prepared. And then he went into the caravan to write his suicide note. The reason I know that was because he told me all about it. What happened next? He was writing the suicide note in the caravan. He had the radio on. And who came on the radio? Ajahn Brahm. The ABC were doing some interview with me. And he just had the radio on, listening to all sorts of stuff. And the interview came on. And he hit his head on the table. Oh, no, I can't get away from Ajahn Brahm. So he gave up. He did untie the noose and decided to carry on. This was lucky karma. Don't go on the radio that much. But just enough to keep him alive. So sometimes, you know, kind people, it's not so much, this is, again, being serious, it's not so much what you're saying, but how you say it sometimes, with kindness, with lightness, you know, with some love. And that just reaches a person. They realize they don't need to commit suicide. Anyway, please talk to us of the other realms. The other realms. I mean, the other realms of existence, or the other planets, or the other realms of existence in the heaven realms. I know yesterday we did so many ghost stories. Heavenly stories. Heavenly stories are a little bit more inspiring. And this story, the best heavenly story, I haven't told you, have I? That's the one. I know you keep liking this. Sorry? Yeah, yeah, that one, yeah. This was a gentleman which I knew. And he was in the Peace Corps in Thailand for a couple of years. And when he finished his couple of years in the Peace Corps, he wanted to try being a monk, to ordain. But he didn't really know how to ordain, what to do if you want to become a monk in Thailand. So he was staying in a hotel on the edge of Bangkok where it was cheap. He asked a concierge, you know, I want to become a monk, what do I do? Now the concierge in Thai hotels know many places to go, but not actually where to go to become a monk. So he gave us some really silly advice. He said, go to this temple, there's Western monks there, go really early in the morning, take some food to offer on arms round to any senior monk and ask the senior monk, you want to become a monk? Try that. So this Westerner, he was an American, he got some food, went to, I think on a taxi, very early in the morning to this monastery called Wat Pa Won, and was waiting for the monks to come out on Bindaba, on arms round. But he arrived there so early in the morning. Everything was locked up. There was hardly any people there. And he was walking up and down outside, wondering what to do. Hardly anyone around. But there was one Thai man came up to him, asked him what he was doing. And he said he wanted to become a monk. And this is what he was told. And the Thai man, who spoke perfect English, said, well, the monks won't be out for a couple of hours. But, said the man, I know the monastery, I've got the keys, I can let you in and show you around. So this was early in the morning, maybe 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, and he opened the gate, the metal gate, and took him inside the main ordination hall, like the Holy of Holies, the main Dhamma hall there, which they use for ceremonies. And he turned the lights on, opened the door of the hall, and on these ancient Thai temples, they have all these paintings on the wall, the murals. If ever you see those murals, they're very hard to understand. They're all about like Jataka tales or stories of the Buddha, but the chronology of it is very, very hard to interpret because it starts in one corner and goes this way and that way and all around. And if you know the story and you can recognize the characters on the mural, you can understand what the story is, where it begins and where it ends. You know, in Garfield cartoons, they start at the left and go down to the right, so you actually can understand, you know, what comes first, what comes last. But these murals on the wall, they're all over the place. But anyway, this Thai gentleman knew everything about these murals, explained them, it was so interesting. He even knew just, you know, who painted them and why they painted them. Somebody was making merit, good karma for a person who died. And it was fascinating, he said. And the time went so quickly, and then the man, when he just finished the last painting, he timed it to perfection, said, now just go outside, go out the gate, I'll lock up, Turn right and there'll be an old monk will come out soon. You ask him. And that's what this American did. He went out, monk came out, he said, I want to become a monk, gave him some food. And the elderly monk said, just wait here and I'll take you inside when I come back. And started the process of ordination. And it takes a long while to learn all of the chanting and stuff. So he started that process. But the Thai monk they gave him to explain it to him, the English, his grasp of English was not that good. So this American complained, haven't you got someone else who can speak better English? And the monks, as best they could, said, no, this is the best one we have. And that was the time when the American said, what about that layman, the lay attendant who let me in the first day? And they said, what lay attendant? The one who opened the gate for me. And at that, the monks stopped him and said, come and see the abbot. Because the gate, which he said he walked through, I know that place. It is called the Royal Gate. This is where the kings and princes of Thailand become ordained. A temporary ordination. And the only people who can walk through that gate are royalty. And this man just had the key. And the only people who have the key is maybe the abbot, the secretary. And they were surprised because you can't turn the lights on in that place. And even the keys to the hall, no lay attendant has those. And even the old abbot, he was eventually the Sangharaja of Thailand, Somdet Nyana Sangwara, he didn't know all the story of all the those paintings in the temple. So when they took him to the abbot and he started saying these amazing things, the abbot stopped him and called the secretary and asked him to start again because he wanted to record all of this. And when I told this story, even in the Thai embassy in Singapore, after the talk, the Thai ambassador to Singapore stood up and said, yeah, that's true, I'm a disciple of that monastery. This actually happened. But anyway, after telling the story, they were all really impressed. And of course, then they asked, what did that man look like? He said, well, he was Thai. He was wearing traditional old clothes, not modern clothes. What did he look like? And that's where he was scratching his head and looking around. Because how can you describe somebody, from a different culture? You don't really know it so well. And then he's scratching his head, and that's when he froze. Because he saw this man's painting on the wall. It was him. It was King Rama V, who was the main sponsor of that temple. He died many years before. He was a king of Thailand who had the keys to that gate and could go in because he was royalty. And he could open the main hall, which again was built during his reign, and knew everything about the paintings on the walls because he was there when they were painted. And that's what this Westerner remembered. We called it, it's him on the wall, that was him. Now sometimes, if you're a traditional Buddhist, you know all these stories about heavenly beings helping people who want to become monks or nuns. You can open doors which shouldn't be opened. Helping you, inspiring you. So that's one of the really true heavenly being stories. Now, I often wanted that story to be written in Thailand and distributed. But there's the person who really is my main disciple in Thailand. She said to me, be careful because it's all these lays majest laws. And if you translate something a bit wrong, you might get into big trouble. An ex-king. But that's a true story. It actually happened. Heavenly beings helping us. And the other story to say about other beings who really like to help you. They're not all low ghosts. That was the story of the guy at home. And, you know, he was home alone, just his wife was somewhere else. But, you know, he heard this, someone talk to him. And the way he said to him was, go to the casino. And it's really weird. But it said again, go to the casino. So he thought, well, why not? You know, somebody was trying to help him. So he went to the casino. He had the afternoon off work, went in there, and he heard the voice again saying, go to roulette table. Go to roulette table. Well, he went to the roulette table, and he said, put $10 on number 17. It's only 10 bucks. Why not? So he put the $10 on number 17. The croupier turned the wheel and threw the ball into the wheel. Came up on number 17. And he could hear quite clearly. No one else could hear this spirit. The spirit said, yes, yes. Put everything on number 6. So he put everything on number 6. The croupier turned the wheel and threw the ball in. It went round and round and round and round. It fell on number 6. And this guy could hear what was going on with the spirit world. He said, yay, yay, yay. Put everything on number 25. Number 25. So by this time, it was a lot of money. So, you know, a lot of people were actually crowding around. Because, you know, if he won this 3 times in a row, that would be millions. So he put everything on number 25. Everyone was really hushed as the croupier turned the wheel, threw the ball in. It went round and round and round. Like, time stood still because everyone was waiting. It was an incredible bet. It went round and round and round and round. It went into number 25. Then bounced out to the one next to it, number 19. And the man could hear really, really clearly the heavenly being go, oh, shit. Even heavenly beings make mistakes. Ajahn Brahma Wangsa, if Jesus and the Buddha had a fight, who would win? if Jesus and the Buddha would have a fight, what would actually happen? That once, okay, this is the story of Nalagiri, the elephant. This is a lovely story, and I use this for when you're meditating and you have lots and lots of problems when you're meditating. So there was someone tried to kill the Buddha at the very end. You know, they wanted to take over, you know, the Buddha's role, his cousin, Devadatta. But anyway, what they did, remember in those days, the streets would be really narrow. If you want to understand, you go to the old parts of London, really, really narrow streets, built for horses, you know, not for cars. And so it was a very narrow street. The Buddha was going on arms round. In the opposite direction, they fed lots of alcohol to this elephant, and they'd let the elephant go in the direction of the Buddha. So the Buddha was walking, and the elephant was coming towards him. And people were running and saying, get out quickly, there's an elephant coming, it's drunk, it's mad, it's crazy, you'll get killed. And all the monks, they jumped over the walls, they went in the doors, they climbed the trees. And that was one of the questions of King Milinda many centuries later. He said, why? Those are supposed to be enlightened monks. Why did they climb the trees? Were they scared? And the monk said, no. They had to get out of the way to allow this event to happen. That's what it said. You can make that what you want. But anyway, Ananda, the devoted disciple of the Buddha, went in front of the Buddha. Let the elephant kill me. I will save my devoted master. And what did the Buddha do? Out of the way, Ananda. I can handle this.
And so it was just Ananda. So just the Buddha and Nala Giri, this huge, mad, crazy elephant, coming to meet one another, getting closer and closer and closer. Who would win? So what happened was the Buddha had such amazing psychic powers. This Buddha was so strong. If the Buddha wanted to, he could grab the elephant by the trunk, swirl it three times around his head, and throw it over the Ganges, you know, about 200 kilometers away. That'd be easy for the Buddha. Would the Buddha do that?
No.
No. Instead, the Buddha gave loving kindness to the elephant. Something like, "Dear elephant, the door of my heart is always open to you, no matter what you ever do to me. You can pick me up with your trunk and smash me against one of the houses. You can trample me with all four of your huge feet, but I will never have any feeling of animosity, anger, or will towards you at all. Dear elephant, the door of my heart is open to you." You know what happened next? That elephant was just so overcome by unconditional loving kindness. The elephant stopped in front of the Buddha, bowed its head, and the Buddha was stroking its trunk. That's how the Buddha faced the danger, with great loving kindness. So if the Buddha and Jesus were having a fight, the Buddha would say, "Jesus, the door of my heart is open to you. You can do whatever you want to me, but I will never have ill will or anger or violence towards you." And Jesus would bow his head. That's my version of the story. But for meditation, because I developed this story when one day somebody came along and said, "Oh, you know, I have an attack of all the hindrances, all five of them at once." "So you mean you have sloth and torpor and restlessness at the same time?" "Oh, yeah. But anyway, I have all the hindrances, everything. I go mad trying to meditate, nothing's working. So what do? You do the Nala Giri practice. You say to your crazy mind, your hindrances, your defilements, the poisons, everything. Say, "Defilements, hindrances, you can do with me whatever you want. The door of my heart is open to you. You can drive me insane, crush me. You can make me mad, but I will never be upset at you." You give unconditional loving kindness to your hindrances. That's called the Nala Giri strategy. And it works. All your hindrances, after a while, they bow down for you and you can stroke them. They're crazy mind. Anyway, what is the meaning of this Pali text, Ajahn? Nanatta kaya, nanatta sanya. That's different bodies, different perceptions. That is one of the beings, the realm of the beings. Anyway, thank you, Ajahn, for this good retreat. Anyway, I don't know why you want to know that, but it's, I think, sometimes some beings who get reborn in different realms have different bodies, different perceptions. Sometimes loving kindness alone does not seem to work on 3-year-old toddlers who cannot reason when trying to discipline them. If letting it be really a key, if physical punishment unkind, how do we strike the right balance between kindness and disciplining? Obviously, it's a physical disciplining. You get into big trouble because of that, because sometimes even the kid doesn't understand what you're doing that for. And the kid might hate you forever because of that. So sometimes there's other ways of disciplining a kid. I know this. Now, one of the things which comes up, now use your greater intelligence and wisdom. Sometimes a nice way of developing and disciplining in kids is called bribery. And it works, because that was the story of Anatta Pindika, who offered the Jeta Grove Monastery to the Buddha. So he's really rich. But like every father throughout time, He had a son who was not interested in Buddhism at all, not interested in meditation, not interested in doing anything except messing around and having a good time. So what did his father do? His father said, well, son, you know, just, you know, you're my son, I love you, and I know you don't want to go and visit the Buddha, but if you go into the Jeta Grove Monastery, for every hour you spend there, I'll give you $100, or something like that. Isn't it quite a bit of money? So whenever the kid needed, you know, some money, he'd just go into the monastery, just, you know, lean against the wall, fall asleep, or just mess around. Big monastery, and he'd get $100, no questions asked. And that went on for quite a while. And then one day, he needed some money, so he went into the temple, and he was just lazing around, but he got bored. He saw all these people going to see the Buddha. So you know what happened next? He just went in the back and just listened. When he listened, it was interesting. And after interesting, he was actually inspired. And after inspired, he became a disciple. He went back to his dad and said, Dad, I'll give all the money back to you. Thank you so much. He never forced his son to actually listen to the Buddha, just go into the temple, knowing that eventually his son will listen to the Dhamma. It's like one of the women here, not in actually this retreat, but you know, she told me, she was from Malaysia, and she said her Australian husband, you know, would never get interested in religion at all, like going to the pub, watching the football, but religion, no. And she said, I know he'd really benefit, you know, from meditation and good advice. How can I convert him? I said, easy. This actually is a true story, it actually worked. I said, get one of my books, the one I just wrote at the time, The Opening the Door of Your Heart, take it home. And she said, he won't read that. I said, listen, take it home, tell your husband this is a holy book, don't touch it, keep your fingers off it, it's mine. Of course, you know what happened next. You know, the husband said, she can't say that to me. I can read whatever I want. And so he picked it up and read it from cover to cover. Now it comes every week. That's how you do it. Or even one of our presidents before, you know, Rachel, she admits that she got totally conned by me because she's a businesswoman and she was far too busy to be the president of our Buddhist society. And so I invited her once, we needed a president. You know, come on, you'll do a really good job. Be the president of our Buddhist society, you know, help for a year or two. She said, no, I'm too busy. So what are you doing? And she told me all the things she was doing. I said, oh, I didn't realize you were so busy. You know, okay, fair enough. No, please don't even think about it. Please don't even make any submission. You want to be the president. I will ban you for that. You can't be it, okay? Now, listen, don't try and be the president. When she heard that from me, she said, no monk's going to tell me what to do. And she put in a submission and she was elected. You ask her if heavy sins. She's the Rachel of the Armadale group. Anyway, you mentioned it would be wise to learn from other teachers. Can you recommend any? Yeah, Ajahn Pamali. Obviously, besides Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Brahm. If you don't like Ajahn Brahm, try Ajahn Brahma Wangsa. He's not bad. Could you please say something about skillful effort? How do I know when the will comes? It's when you get tense. That's when the will comes. Skillful effort is that which leads to peace and contentment and doesn't want anything. What are you putting effort for? Where do you want to go? So you ask yourself, have the wisdom, what am I doing this for? Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. I came here with a heavy coat. Oh, I came here with heavy coats I didn't realize I carried. Some have fallen away. Through your teachings of the Dhamma and your wise, insightful stories, I leave here much lighter. Many blessings, much love, and deep respects. Someone, the loser. You've lost many things. That's wonderful. Sometimes during this retreat, I felt lost. Excellent. You got there. You're supposed to get lost. You've managed it. Well done. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Oh, anxious. Not knowing what to do in life, whereas sometimes I felt at peace in the right place in life. Feeling lost and anxious is frightening. How to look and deal with those moments? Thank you very much for the retreat. Being lost, you know, is, if you look at it, it's far more interesting in life. If you know, what do you want to do in life? Sometimes giving people all the answers is looking at the final pages of a book to find out what what happens in the book. But it's much nicer to have a sense of almost like adventure, discovery. What really is peace and how deep can peace be? So, feeling anxious, why do people feel anxious? Sometimes it's a quality which we habituated to have. And one of the reasons is that we have anxiety. The more we have, the more we own, the less we've lost, the more anxious we can become. Because the anxiety is losing something which, you know, you think you own. The more close it is to your idea of yourself, the personal possessions, you can get very anxious of losing those. But little by little, as you lose more and more of your sense of ownership, what you own in life, then you have less opportunity to be anxious. There's sometimes people say the most scariest thing to do is to give a public talk. That's how I live. I always give public talks. Even worse is on TV. Because apparently, I've never seen it, but they have this show called Bloopers. So somebody makes a big mistake on TV. They show it in special programs all over the world. The monk who picked his nose and got his finger stuck in his nose or something, I don't know. But when you make a mistake, sometimes people get so embarrassed. As for me, when I started giving talks, I thought, no need to get embarrassed. If I do something wrong or something really, really stupid, that would be wonderful. That would mean I wouldn't need to give any talks ever again. I could stay in my cave and be peaceful. Yay! In other words, you don't worry what other people think of you, how they judge you. Just in the same way, earlier today I said, I'm not going to give any certificates on this retreat. You're not going to be judged. If you're not going to be judged, why are you feeling anxious? You're not going to gain anything, you're not going to lose anything, you're just going to be you. And you can feel so comfortable just being who you are, rather than trying to be someone you can never be. You're just you. And it's wonderful to be accepted as you are. And that's called unconditional love. Sometimes you have a few people in life, sometimes it may be your grandma, knows you like chips, and will just fry you some in your time. And it's just that gesture of unconditional acceptance. Not criticizing you. It's up to you, you know, how many chips you want. But she'll always fry some for you. That unconditional love is actually where you lose anxiety. What are you afraid of? We don't have anything. Got nothing to lose. That's why, you know, you can go into my cave. I won't go there. I actually haven't been in there since. I won't go in there and check that everything is there, that you haven't pinched anything. There's nothing there to steal. Maybe the bat. But I've got a couple of bats. I've got another bat in the main room. I don't need to go in the office as well. Have a look there. Because someone gave me this skull. It's a real human skull. It's over about 200 years old. They gave me another bat, a black bat, much more scary. And I put it over the skull. It looks really freaky. And that's my security. So anyone who wants to steal anything, they go in there, ah! and run away. A human skull with a bat on top. Felt a good idea for me. Anyway, so that's when you lose all your anxiety. You've got nothing to lose. Yay! People are anxious about passing exams. They're anxious of losing money. I've already lost my money a long time ago. Got nothing. I don't know if I'm going to eat tomorrow. Well, my grandma's dead now, so I can't go to her for some chips. But of course I know I'm going to get fed tomorrow. I know I've got a nice place to sleep at night, so what are you anxious for? So anyway, anxious, ask yourself, why am I anxious? What am I afraid of losing? And then after a while you think, okay, I can lose it, no worries. That's how you deal with those moments. Develop wisdom. Last question. Only 19. 19 let goes. But you know, some of these questions, people think they're anonymous. But sometimes, tomorrow, you know, you write these little pieces of paper about your experiences in the monastery and do you want your money back and stuff like that. It doesn't take much, does it, to compare the handwriting. Be careful. Okay. Anyway, thanks for those questions. That's just the last question. The basket is empty. And all the basket case questions have been answered to the best of my ability. Some of you may have got good answers. Some people may think the answers weren't good enough. But that's on purpose. Not to fully answer the questions. So I can have some clients for the next retreat. Sadhu. 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 Okay, so I hope you enjoyed so far. This is the last question time. And tomorrow there's a special schedule because it's the last day. So hopefully you've seen that schedule. It's on the whiteboard. Yeah, very good. And I know sometimes people have to leave earlier, so I wish you all happiness and well-being. And there's another talk and a loving-kindness meditation tomorrow morning. So I'll see you then. So see ya. Bye.